The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I hope this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes, sorts, sizes, and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell. Radically trying to put out some fires right now. I don't know what happened. Everything was borked going from my like OBS kind of setup here into Restream. Everything was like mirror imaged and backwards, and I have no idea what settings set all that off. But we finally made it to live. We're here. Al Sabakli in the pre-show helping me sort out some weird video images. We've got Barry Johnson saying yo, we've got Bray Gray saying good morning, El Jefe Review saying hey, Own Scott, J-Man150, Ron Guido. We already have a crew ready to go. I hope everybody had a lovely weekend, especially if you are of the persuasion to celebrate say a holiday like Easter. I hope that you had a lovely Easter, and for all of the other denominations and sort of special holy days that are all kind of landing around the same time, that I hope you got to. My wish is always that you that you're safe, warm, well fed, and getting to spend time with people who care about you. And for us, it was like just a really beautiful triple whammy. Lex was on spring break, so all last week we had Lex at home. We were planning fun outings. We did a zoo day, did a lot of bike riding, and I'm really excited about that. Finally got Marie a nice little road bike that I will actually be showing off on the channel soon. And then today is my wife and I's 19th wedding anniversary. So we kind of lost sight of the fact that last year our marriage was old enough to vote. So this year, we're only a couple years away from our marriage being old enough to drink. She got me a lovely little card. So the card she got me is 80% of marriage is figuring out where to go or what to have for dinner. And then she says, happy anniversary to the best decision I ever made. She is the sweetest. I doubt she's watching right now, but if she is, I love you, Marie. I think right now she's downstairs. I could probably just like tell her that, but I just feeling really good. This was a great, like, everything leading into this weekend. We had kind of a spring break Easter anniversary weekend. It was really quite lovely. So not to like make it like keeping score or anything, but I hope everyone else out there had as lovely a weekend too. So salud and the happiest of happies. And I'm going to take a quick drink of coffee here. Thank you everybody in the chat. That's so sweet. I'm going to just lots of congratulations and happy anniversaries and things like that. So really, really appreciate it. So this week, Onscon is asking, is there a third platform that this stream is on? I saw three different icons in the stream's chat view. The YouTube logo, the Twitch logo, and a P. What's the P stand for? So this goes up on... this stream goes up on Twitch, obviously, is the main thing that I pay attention to for the chat. There is a stream that goes to like my personal Facebook, but that's been on autopilot for years. I literally have not logged into my Facebook account for any practical or active use of Facebook. I stopped using it about a year before the pandemic. So I think it still goes to Facebook. I have no idea. And then there's also a flavor of the stream that goes to LinkedIn. I finally got approved to do like the LinkedIn beta test for live streaming content. And so I signed up and I put in my LinkedIn credentials on Restream. And again, I don't do anything on LinkedIn. It's just another sort of autopilot stream. So if you can't catch, like, for example, if your work blocks Twitch, well, you can tell people you can watch this stream on LinkedIn, you know, for the real doing the business. I'm a businessman and I do business. Yeah, I was surprised as anyone else, J-Man. He says, wait, you can stream on LinkedIn? I have a couple friends that are like, yeah, I'm going to host like a business podcast talking about business. And every week it's basically just like, oh, bootstraps and no handouts and bootstraps and be hustling always. Always be closing, ABC. And I have zero interest in becoming a part of the LinkedIn zeitgeist. It seems exhausting. It really does. So this week's tech news is crazy. We have been living in interesting times, right? You know, like, this is the kind of stuff that we'll look back on in history books and go, yeah, like, I understand why that's like a curse. May you live in interesting times. We've got a crazy news block. We've got some really fun stuff to kind of, ponder in the gadget block. Some leaks, some pre-orders. And just kind of following up on some of the gadgets and stuff out right now. So I want to try and chew through all of this news. I feel like the news block is going to run a little long. And then on top of that, I also kind of feel like some of my housekeeping is a little precious too. So let's jump into some housekeeping. Let's try and get through this efficiently, because I mean, it's like every one of these stories on its own would have been a major tech breaking news, occupy the whole week, let's talk about it kind of story. And they're hitting so fast that we get a headline and we're immediately hit with something else. And it's really difficult to keep up with the thread of the narrative. I had to change one of the links four times this morning because of updates and new breaking news and new parts of the conversation. So that's me actively trying to put together a podcast, and I guarantee you by the time I'm done with this podcast, there will have been some other addition to one of these stories. Like, it's that fast, and the fallout from these stories is happening so quickly we can't even really react to it. So, I can also get rid of this. I had the music muted but still playing in the background. That always makes my stream kind of weird. If my audio starts sounding weird, someone please let me know. Because I have no idea what's going on with the stream. It just got weird. But I did use this as an opportunity to make my little at some gadget guy watermark a little bit smaller. I just keep thinking about it, but like, I literally have to click three buttons in OBS to change that. I'll do that next time. So I finally did it now because I broke a whole bunch of stuff. All right. Getting into some housekeeping here. Let's make sure I can still show Firefox. There we go. So last week was actually a pretty fun production week. Got a couple videos out and then also got to link to some of our Slick Deals content. The big video was this one right here on the screen, why you don't want a 1-inch type sensor in your phone camera. Now, this is part two of this kind of slow miniseries that I'm putting together on optics and photography for 1-inch type sensors. I really feel like the whole thing about 1-inch sensors is getting lost in all of the smartphone hype. So we hype up these technologies, and then consumers get this phone, and you're like, yeah, but it's kind of the same camera that I've been shooting with. Oh, but it's got a different chamber for photons to improve low light performance, and you can do megapixels, and you can do, and you take a picture, and it's like, it's kind of the same picture. And the reason that is because the person is still doing the exact same thing with that camera that they did with their previous camera. What we need to do, and I'm talking to the crew here, because I know we're the ambassadors. What we need to do is explain to people, if you want to expand on your technique, then that's why hardware matters. If you're happy with take phone out of, or I like to demonstrate this with this. So take phone out of pocket, push shutter, and put phone back in pocket. Stop it like a $300 phone. Like, you're done. You are well satisfied. Your photos are going to look great. That's handled. There's no reason to buy an $800 iPhone for that kind of photography. But if you want to do even just a little bit more than literally that, like take phone out of pocket, push shutter, put phone back in pocket. If you take phone out of pocket, adjust the angle of phone, tap on someone's face to focus, and push shutter button, you are immediately at a higher tier of photography than what we estimate average consumers to be. So the series that I'm doing on the 1-inch camera sensor is to try and illustrate what some of these photographic and compositional differences might be between a more expensive smartphone camera and a less expensive smartphone camera. Vivo got me really lit up about this. Xiaomi got me really lit up about this. And I'm still anxious that the United States is going to continue to fall further and further behind in new cool technology. So it's on the blog, somegadgetguy.com. But this is another one of the fun videos that we just put out at Slick Deals, the best Adidas deals. And it's a game show that they're trying to create. And I really hope we can turn this into a regular segment where Slick Deals has this enormous amount of like market data on old deals and sales. And it's just kind of fun, like Price is Right style, to go back through some of that archive and say, well, what was the absolute best deal we've ever seen on this? And then, so my producer, Pete, he's here in the thumbnail. He set up this game show to try and set up a sort of like a challenge. And the audience can also kind of play along too. But basically, they put me on the spot, and I am miserable at deal hunting. Like, it's really not a strength of mine. I'm really happy to be working with the Slick Deals team, because they kind of slide stuff over to me and like, whoa, that is actually a really good deal. I will buy one of those. So they put me on the spot and I have to guess, and then it's like sort of closest to the actual dollar amount, and I almost always lose. I really, really almost always lose. Moving right along. I also got another video out. This one was just sort of the passion project, looking back at phones from 2022, and I have to give the Moto Edge Plus. If I gave awards to phones, the Moto Edge Plus would earn my most improved phone of 2022. That I still have my SIM card in it right now. I even took the time to repair my Tick Watch to go to my Moto. It really has become one of the most surprising performers of all the 8 Gen 1 powered phones out there. And In a really interesting way, has also become one of the better behaved. Like, it started out last year as one of the most powerful, but also one of the most concerningly hot phones. It was one of the first phones that we really got to see those benchmarks on the 8 Gen 1. And we were showing people like, wow, this phone is playing this game and it's doing really well, but it's also like 130 degrees Fahrenheit. You're like, that's really hot. Watch the battery completely evaporate. And since then, it's gotten a lot better behaved. So it was just like an important video for me to put out, because I think it changes the conversation and it moves the conversation in some really interesting ways, especially like Moto's handle on software. I really like Moto's strategy for updating components on the phone better than any other manufacturer out there. we can make fun of them that they're still on Android 12, but now this has become one of the best performing phones of its generation. I don't know how much I care that it went from like sort of 12, 12L to 13, because 13 is more about tablet-y stuff, and I have Ready 4. So if I have Ready 4, I already have an immensely better, larger screen version of the phone to use. So Android 13 doesn't bother me as much, but we should get after them for some of the other pokey things. They've been up to date on their security, their individual components, like the camera updates have been flipping phenomenal. And then when you do get, like, hey, there's an update to Ready 4, it just gets sent directly to the phone. You have to wait for some big, dumb OTA. So it's just a different conversation, and that's one of the major bummers is, like, it takes so much extra explanation. Like, it's a big chunk of this video going back to reiterate. If you're used to how a Samsung does things, this is different, but that's not necessarily bad. It just depends on what you expect. I expect that when an app on my phone is ready to be updated, it should just get updated. I don't like this strategy of, hey, we have to wait for an OTA. Like, that to me is not a good update strategy, and especially when it has to go through carriers. When I have, like, the three different Moto camera components that go into the Edge Plus, I don't have to wait for T-Mobile or Verizon to decide that my camera is ready to be updated. Just gets updated. So that to me is a better strategy. I feel like that's worth pointing out. So those were the biggies. And then I finally put something out. I'm a little disappointed in myself. I started writing out, I almost finished. It was like mostly done. I had to go through and start editing and kind of trimming sections, because when I write a camera review, I usually end up getting to like 6,000 words, and then I try to whittle that back. I'm very long-winded in how I explain things. I feel like this housekeeping is emblematic of that. So I had the Note 23. I took it from my usual just like short-term test drive. I don't use Samsung, so I don't keep Samsungs. I got through most of the script, and it was really bugging me. And if you're on the Patreon, I've explained this in a dedicated Patreon post. But here for folks on the podcast, spoiling that little production diary post here. I got through the script and it was really bugging me. And I couldn't quite put my thumb on why did this script just feel... It just felt like repetitive. It felt like it felt like a rehash. And so then I took a second and I went and rewatched my Note 22 camera review. And genuinely, like, most of that script could have been cribbed. Like, I was joking around with Barry. Barry's still in the chat. I was joking around with Barry and, like, we were saying, like, what if I just took the Note 22 video and cut out a couple of the sections that had changed and then see if anyone noticed? And I ultimately decided against that because that's not really how I want to run my Patreon. I don't want to run my Patreon like it's a gotcha or there are jokes in there or something like that. Especially because I take my camera review seriously to the point of not finishing as many camera reviews as I'd like to. And so instead, I wrote the production diary and I said, like, I can't sit here and shoot another 40-minute video where the conclusion of every section of the video is, and this is basically unchanged from the Note 22. The telephoto performance, basically unchanged from the Note 22. The ultra-wide, it's a different sensor, and it's basically unchanged from the Note 22. Oh, look at this video performance is basically unchanged from the Note 22. Look at all of these features that competitors have that the Galaxy doesn't have is completely unchanged from the Note 22. So I have it up on the Patreon now. This is the camera conclusion, which is what I used to call just the short form videos we would put out on YouTube. And I love that YouTube picked this. Like, I'm basically making, I don't know, some sort of like Soyjack meme face. It caught me mid articulation, but they at least pulled the image with the moon zoom, which is still one of the dumbest things to pin, marketing on, where Samsung is basically lying about the performance of the auto mode telephoto sensors, and that makes me really frustrated. Because it's stuff like that. I'll spoil part of the conclusion of this here in the podcast. There are improvements. There are things that I feel photographers are really going to enjoy, even in a one-year upgrade, going from the Note 22 to the Note 23. And Samsung's marketing makes that job so much more difficult to try and express to people, if you like what the Note 22 does and it does this, you're really going to like what the Note 23 does because it refines that. But Samsung is like 200 megapixels and take photos of the moon. And you're like, neither of those deliver a tangible improvement to the consumer photography experience. Like I said at the beginning of this podcast, someone is going to get a Note 23 and they'll have come from a Note 20 and they're going to take a couple photos and it's going to be kind of the same, but they were promised moon and megapixels. And maybe that person tries to convince themselves that, like, oh yeah, no, this is so exciting. Look at how much better these photos are. They're huge. You can crop so much. Whoa. But that individual is not able to side by side a Note with another premium tier Android phone. They might not even be able to side by side the Note 23 against the Note 20. And at some point, you've got to call out when the emperor has no clothes, right? That's what's saddest to me is Samsung's marketing is doing an active disservice to what their own product actually does well, or at least in my opinion. So that was a really long-winded way of kind of teasing. The camera conclusion is up on the Patreon, so you can check that out. Oh, Easy Computer Solutions hanging out in the chat. What's up, Easy? Easy says, I'm be right at 5,000 words. I thought I was long-winded, LOL. Well, I still don't know if I'm going to shoot the video, and I haven't gotten any real feedback on it, especially from folks on the Patreon. But so far, my why I'm a Samsung hater script is at 9,300 words. So you want to hear long-winded, I can get long-winded. That's a lot. I can talk a lot. And especially when it's something that I feel like a company I was super passionate about. So I just got to take a quick pause here for our... J-Man150 is rocking it right now, gifting tier one subs to... There we go. J-Man150 has gifted a tier one sub to Flying Squirrel 625, to Otaku2X, and to Chris the Turd Hurdler. And he's also asking me to hydrate. So thank you so much, J-Man, and especially lately in the stream and on the podcast last couple of weeks. Please, I very much appreciate it. And I definitely notice all the people that have been supporting and sharing and contributing and stuff. But I really do appreciate coming out for the live stream and then also hooking other people up too. So thank you so much. And I will absolutely slurp on some water with my mic muted in celebration of your generosity. All right. So all of the links, all of the articles, all of the housekeeping that we've talked about up to this point will be available on this week's show notes on the blog, somegadgetguide.com. You can catch all the links right there. We're going to start off the news block. I don't love giving Elon Musk a lot of attention, but this is the kind of market correction news reporting and data that I feel his antics and his companies currently deserve. We need to do a better job of kind of following up on news stories like these. And this is a really funny situation where it's not just Twitter fallout. We're seeing sort of the little cracks in the armor at several of his companies right now. And this is not the first time I have reported on this strategy for satellite communication. So this story is coming from Gizmodo. All of these stories like were reported on pretty heavily throughout the tech community. I always just try to side with whoever I saw first. Unless someone like really links an article and says, well, according to Bloomberg, this, and then I'll try to dig up the Bloomberg article. But Gizmodo hit me first. SpaceX's next-gen Starlink satellites have started falling from space. It's been a little over a month since SpaceX launched 21 mini versions of its next-generation Starlink satellites, but it appears that one of those little guys just couldn't cling to orbit any longer. Satellite designated as 30062 re-entered Earth's atmosphere on Monday at 4:50 a.m. off the coast of California, according to a tweet from Jonathan McDowell, a Harvard Smithsonian astrophysicist who keeps tabs on SpaceX's internet satellites. This was written up by Passant Rabi over at Gizmodo. And I'm throwing this up here because, like, one satellite isn't a huge deal. But when I was at reviews.org, one of the very first one of the very first videos that I contributed on was how an entire Starlink constellation fell out of the sky. And so now we've put up another group of satellites. We're constantly throwing satellites back up into space. It's low Earth orbit, so it's really hanging right on the edge of like the barrier between our atmosphere and space. And this, to me, speaks to the inefficiency of our current implementation of satellite internet communications. I do not believe that this is going to be, in its current form, and we need better technologies and we need to expand on it, but what we're doing right now, I do not believe is going to be sustainable, because we have to spend a lot of money shooting satellites up into space, and we know they're not going to last very long and that they're going to burn up in the atmosphere, and then we need to shoot more satellites up into space. This is something that governments will do to sort of make their communications network more robust. This is never going to be, in its current incarnation, it's never going to be a great consumer broadband strategy. The whole promise of Starlink was sold as this way that, like, oh, don't worry about running more cable or running more DSL or running fiber to home. We're going to shoot satellites up into the sky, and isn't that going to be so much easier? And every single time we do that, I feel we deliver these huge compromises. I just recently took the Verizon 5G home broadband, fixed wireless broadband, for a spin. It worked way better than I was expecting it to. It was not any faster than cable. So we can't make wireless as robust, as consistent, and as fast as fiber, right? That just can't happen. So instead of really doing the work and getting through local approvals and zoning and wiring up homes, which would be a huge benefit for the economy, for the energy grid, for communications, for services, would make every service easier to use, more accessible, would be better for startups. We're going to keep playing these games with, well, what if we just set up a cell phone tower? What if we shot more satellites into space? And it doesn't solve the issue we have with bandwidth and cost-effective communications. What SpaceX is hoping for is that numerous governments will lean on this, and then they can get a ton of taxpayer subsidies, right? Well, if you want to keep using the Starlink, we got to keep shooting satellites into space, so we need those tasty, tasty tax dollars. I'm Elon Musk. I'm going to move to Texas so I don't have to pay taxes, but I need those tax dollars to keep my businesses afloat, you see. See, that's how you do the business. You sell it to consumers and you get them excited about it, but then you really lean on the government so you can get the consumers' money without even having to sell anything to the consumers, right? That's how it all works. That's how it just works. So I also have to throw another bow, 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 J-Man150 gifting a tier one sub to Dmitri. Thank you so much, J-Man150. And I guess I'll dedicate this next article to you. Because Twitter is in another state of political meltdown. There's a side story to this where watchdog groups have been following Twitter's policing of data. Right now, we could be seeing some pretty hefty fines out of Germany because Twitter is not keeping up with stemming the spread of disinformation. So they're running afoul of EU regulations when it comes to weaponized misinformation. At the same time, outside auditors don't believe Twitter is doing much of anything to try and rein in Chinese and Russian media on their platform. This is becoming a source for spreading tactical misinformation and to cloud every earnest conversation on the platform. Then on top of that, Twitter recently started targeting more, you want to say like NPR. NPR is not actually a left-leaning news service, but they, according to NPR's own audits, they actually focus more on conservative politics than they do liberal politics. But when they just try to talk about conservative politics and they say, hey, this is what's happening, then conservatives get angry because they didn't want people to talk about that part of it. So this is the story that I had to revise several times. The first article I linked to, Twitter had labeled NPR a U.S. state-affiliated media. Then NPR basically stopped posting at all on Twitter. And then Twitter came back and has relabeled them as government-funded, which again is basically a label that you use as a dog whistle to say that NPR is not a reputable news agency because they receive money directly from the government, so their coverage of topics must be biased or manipulated by said government. And that's not really how NPR functions. I listen to a lot of NPR, and I like NPR for often having some of the more calm and measured responses to news stories. Their editorials are phenomenal, and it's a presentation of news that I feel is far less manufactured and hyped. There's less of that immediate outrage, this is how you should think about the story, when you follow NPR. Whether or not you believe that that's always completely free of any type of outside influence or manipulation, I feel we'll probably never have a clear and concise answer on that. But what Twitter is doing is, I feel, rather despicable, because they're trying to cast doubt. They're trying to make NPR look less credible as an organization. And it's just kind of funny, and this article even brings it up too. I'm not landing this joke. Other people, they have a tweet in here, which is funny. It's like hot takes on Twitter, right? Here, let me click that back in. From Bobby, is that Bobby Allen? I actually don't know who Bobby Allen is. New label on NPR's main account changed to government-funded, and Elon tells me Twitter is applying it to a large number of institutions. Now, in the article here from Igor Bonifacic, I have mispronounced your name and I apologize, this government-funded label doesn't appear on companies like Tesla or SpaceX, who have basically survived thanks to large amounts of government funding and taxpayer dollars. So, I feel like they're being a little cavalier and a little inconsistent with their government-funded label. So I appreciate Gizmodo. I know this was Engadget. Engadget is Igor. I appreciate Engadget kind of throwing that little fork poke in there because, you know, it's hypocrisy. Oh, man. J-Man150. J-Man50 has gifted a tier 1 sub to Sveticus, and another concept creator has gifted a tier 1 sub to Las Divine. And then J-Man150 is right back with Kyoto Terosanti, who I've mispronounced all of your names. Sveticus and Las Divine and Kyotero Suanti. I apologize. But thank you, J-Man150 and Concept Creator. That is awesome. That's great. Thanks so much. I really appreciate that. And Simon says, no, this is why I really appreciate NPR. Simon says, NPR has actual discussions rather than soundbite-driven faux outrage. When they do interviews and when they host some of those conversations, I think you do get a better sense of what the stakes are. I feel like even when they come to conclusions on like what the damage or the fallout can be, I feel like NPR still holds to an old kind of like Walter Cronkite idea of what news should represent, as opposed to what opinion should be delivered. And oh man, Jermaine just gifted a tier one sub to Fat Produce, my buddy Andrew. Jermaine, thank you so much. That is awesome. You guys are rocking. And there's a hype train. So we're already into level two of the hype train. Go hype, hype, hype train. Choose you. Excellent. Well, the hits just keep on coming, and we don't have to spend a lot of time on this next story here. You remember, okay, drop a one in the chat if you remember when EUFY, the Anker sub-brand of security cameras, when they were found sending unencrypted images back to their servers, because that's how you interacted with like the web version of the app. If you wanted to see like a screenshot of something from your camera, it would take a photo of it from the camera, send it up to a server, then it would come back down. But that was unencrypted. Remember, so like, yeah, Patelevision is putting a one in the chat. Simon says Hypno is putting a one in the chat. I have to do another pause here. For El Jefe Reviews. Are you kidding me? We just finished level two. We're almost done with level three on this hype train. Jeff gifting tier one subs to Hawks TV, Garland, Flowtech Wolf, Professor Bollocks, Kyle Smile 414, and JMan150 coming right back with FHJ Esquire. And Simon Says Hypno and JMan are all telling me to stretch and take a drink of water. We're going to get back to this silly story here, but we've got a one in the chat if you remember how upset we were with UFI cameras. I'm going to take a drink of water and we're going to jump right back in.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
Oh, Jeff, just spreading the love, man. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. You all are making me blush here, seriously. So we got Simon Says Hypno, we have Patelevision, we've got people were very upset about I don't even know how you're supposed to pronounce that. I've done videos with that company, and I'm still like, you know, UFI. And I just try to say it as quickly as I possibly can just to kind of get over it. So, well, this is another just sort of awkward UFI. I'm going to trust Jeff. I believe it's UFI. So we'll go with that. Imagine if the UFI thing happened. Oh, wait. Hold on. Imagine we just broke level three on the hype train. Hype train. Simon Says Hypno says, imagine if the UFI thing happened yet again with another company, would the outrage be there? Well, Simon, you're reading my brain here, because I feel we are at 95% of the way to finishing level four on this hype train. I you're blowing my mind here. This is like the craziest hype train I think I've ever seen doing the Twitch. We're never going to get to this story because you guys are blowing my mind right now. Wow. Okay. So I'm way off. Riding this hype train has jumped me off the tracks of my podcast. Pun, there you go. And now I'm up in ish. I can't believe it. uh,
Okay, so Muppinish has gifted tier one subs to Point Blank 8, Gorin, Zalbotnik, Farhan, and Talks with TJ. And Concept Creator came right back with tier one subs to ArchPGF 12, Daniel James Brewer, Zintech, Paul the Tea Guy. Paul, I love tea. RJO 1440. The Hype Train. What I think we just killed level five too. So that just finished out level five of this Hype Train. Holy cow. Thank you all so much. Short story, incredibly long. Tesla cars spy on you, and it's not horribly dissimilar to security cameras that send unencrypted photos up to some sort of central server. I've got a story here from Ars Technica, of course, from my man crush John Brodkin. Tesla workers shared images from car cameras, including, quote, scenes of intimacy. Ex-staffers tell Reuters about internal image sharing. We could see their kids. So apparently, the cameras that kind of monitor the traffic in a Tesla and can kind of see what's going on inside the car and around the car. Here's the quote from one of the other employees. Some of the recordings caught Tesla customers in embarrassing situations. One ex-employee describes a video of a man approaching a vehicle completely naked. Also shared, crashes and road rage incidents. One crash video in 2021 showed a Tesla driving at high speed in a residential area, hitting a child riding a bike. According to another ex-employee, the child flew in one direction, the bike in another. Video spread around a Tesla office in San Mateo, California, via private one-on-one chats, quote, like wildfire. So, it's unclear whether or not this kind of personal information through Tesla cars has actually stopped. So Reuters has the initial scoop on it. Ars Technica, John does such a great job of kind of condensing all of the stories and links and stuff so you can read all the way through it. I'm linking to the Ars Technica article on this. Jeff, naked, pause, clutches pearls. Yes, okay, so the naked thing is definitely problematic. I feel like it's not so much that they saw a naked man. I feel it's that an image of a naked man was sent from the car to Tesla data centers, and then people working for Tesla were able to find that image of said naked man. And then they took that image of said naked man, and then they shared it to other people in the Tesla organization. So if you do anything around a Tesla car, we now have to assume that there is no expectation of privacy or security for any of the actions, the video or audio that car can capture. I'm not trying to minimize, you know, like the outrage. I feel like it was deserved. I was so disappointed in the response from Eufy cameras when those security cameras were caught not encrypting video or stills from their cameras up to their servers. That's bad. And now there's like this little animation whenever you log into your Eufy camera. I still have the doorbell. I just was too lazy to take it down. I know I should be a little bit more security conscious. But now when you go into your Eufy app and you open the camera, it does this like unlocking mechanism animation. And you're like, yeah, okay, we get it. You got caught. But yeah, for a car that is as internet connected as a Tesla, that's a very bad look for the organization and for the company. So, yeah, Jeff, yeah, you know what, dude? That's probably just good advice. He says Tesla is a bit problematic with that personal data. So no getting freaky in the backseat of a Tesla. Those employees are watching. Oh, yeah, they are. Oh, yeah. So, wow, that one's heavy. And that story broke 4 days ago. I feel the internet's outrage over over Yuffie was legit. I feel we did not see the same level of frustration or of outrage for this story getting broken by Reuters, is seeing Tesla kind of spying on people's personal information and stuff. So we just wrapped the hype train, got, man, 25 subs. You guys are crazy. Oh my gosh. We've got what appears to be some kind of strange bird-like creature for the emote on this hype train. So thank you so much. Let's see if it'll actually pop up. No, it just says choo-choo hype cheer. So unfortunately, Restream won't let me post that one out there right now. But, you know. So "I'll at your boy" has written a comment. And I don't think he intended to sound as dirty as it does, but I need everyone to laugh at LaShawn about his Tesla comment in the back. In the back. I can't, I mean, it's in the, you'll see it in the chat. I can't highlight, I can't post it. I'm not even going to say it just in case anyone is expecting me to hold to a PG-13 podcast. I don't think he meant it that way, but it came out so wrong. Pause, LaShawn. Proofread your comments. Oh, that was beautiful. All right, so that was just the Elon Musk block. Twitter is trying to play games with the depiction of media while not policing Chinese and Russian interests. Starlink satellites are falling out of the sky. And Tesla's spy on you with no expectation of user privacy, where your data and your content will just be shared with other internal members of the Tesla team. That's really bad. Each one of those individually could have been like the story of the week. That's what I mean. It's just exhausting. That comes from the organizations run by one zany billionaire. And we're seeing this kind of problematic corporate behavior and malfeasance. Like, man, that's rough. That is tough. Barry, between the hype train and Juan's laughing, we have just entered instant podcast classic territory. He said it so wrong. Okay. Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah, Juan is dead. Yep. Full on, Jeff. Full on. Legit. Pause, sir. I mean, talking like overgrown puppy. Pause. So, we've got four more stories, but we've got them. I'm going to try and batch these back to back. World went crazy in 2020. And technology sales went absolutely bonkers. And then coming out of a global pandemic, which I'm still not entirely sure we should say we're out of the coronavirus pandemic, but we're seeing some new normal built on going to places in person again. Tech companies just couldn't foresee that people's spending habits would change. Then also factor in a massive downturn in the economy and stuff got real ugly. So I've got a pair of Apple stories and I've got a pair of Samsung stories. So the first Apple story is just, obviously, as I am a left-leaning, bleeding-heart, liberal-style individual, this one just makes me very disappointed in the image that Apple crafts for their brand, which doesn't really reflect the kind of reality of people on the ground who are the driving force of Apple's labor and how they might be treated. This is coming by way of Igor again over at Engadget. Apple reportedly held anti-union meetings at all of its U.S. stores. Some workers described the gatherings as a scare tactic. Apple appears to have taken its most aggressive steps yet to warn its retail employees against unionizing. According to Bloomberg, the company recently held meetings at all of its roughly 270 stores across the United States meant to discuss the risks of unionization. That was a quote. The tone of the gatherings was, quote, consistent across Apple's retail footprint, managers reportedly opened with a prepared statement from corporate leadership before turning to the state of union negotiations in Towson, Maryland, the location of the company's first unionized store in the United States. That's pretty scummy. Again, we have these rules in place where it's like, you're not really legally allowed to do this, but then a $3 trillion corporation can kind of do that, but you don't want to ruffle too many feathers. Like, again, Apple can break IP law, and then we will have serious conversations about whether or not a new technology can even be patented. Well, but I mean, if Apple stole this from another company, maybe it's just something that can't be patented. Like, that's not how innovation works. That's just straight up theft. So I now am, it's the same situation that I had with like Starbucks. I will not buy anything from a Starbucks unless I know I'm going to a store that has unionized. I do not appreciate them having that kind of economic leverage and power over a section of their employee, their workforce, and I'm going to vote with my dollars. I don't love Starbucks, but sometimes you just want a burnt tasting cup of coffee and that's the place to go. But I won't do that unless I know I can land at a store that's organized and is unionized. I don't do any shopping with Apple. I don't go to Apple stores, but now I'm increasingly looking like, well, maybe we need to just set up a map. Is your local Apple store unionized? Do they have better protections for their employees? Do they have better collective bargaining for things like raises and healthcare? I feel like that kind of stuff matters, and it's silly of a company with a $2.5 trillion market cap to spend this much time, money, and effort working against the interests of their employees. And again, technically, they shouldn't be doing things like that, but no one's going to tag Apple for it, right? No one wants to face the wrath of Apple's lawyers in that kind of lawsuit, and instead, these employees are just going to try to work towards bridging that kind of faux libertarian tech bro gap, where I'm sure a lot of Apple employees are true believers in this kind of Apple idea or Apple aesthetic. So it's just really frustrating. Really frustrating that that can just sort of happen. No, we'll just dedicate a significant amount of time, money, effort, resources. We'll hold workshops at all of the stores, and we'll just let people know that maybe it's a bad idea if they do this. It could be bad for you because we're Apple. I'm sure that's what the tone was right there. Right? That was my, you know, Apple, oh, we're so fun and we don't bully people. Tim Cook testified in front of a Senate committee that we don't bully, but it would be bad for you if you unionized. So, yeah. In completely unrelated news, and I'm not making a joke, this is just an awkward transition and I didn't have a good segue. Apple seems to be taking the biggest plunge on PC sales. This one really surprised me. Oh, holla at your boy. That's a good one. I like that. LaShawn says, that's a bad Apple. I see what you did there. That was good. I like that one. This story really surprised me. For all of the technologies that Apple is stealing, one of the technologies that I have been really excited about has been Apple's investment in silicon paying off. I was the nerd at Newegg while we were having these Intel versus AMD fights. I was the one waving my hand way in the back of the office going, but hey guys, what about ARM PCs? They're pretty rad too. And then everyone would say, shut up Juan, we want an Intel, or I want an AMD. And then I would just sort of sit quietly back down. I got one video. They let me do one video at Newegg talking about ARM powered laptops. Because we were seeing some of that investment, like Chromebooks were starting to blow up in sales, and like you can get like a $200 Chromebook that's running off of this smartphone chip, and like that might be all you need. That's pretty good. We're going to give that to students. Was that Juan the Martian? It's like the only two cartoon voices I can do is like I can kind of pull off a Slowpoke Rodriguez when I've had a couple Coronas. Jeff just got me. That was good. So this story kind of shocked me because I really do feel A little less so with the M2. The M2 is kind of iterative, but the Apple M1 was such an important step in legitimizing lower power SoCs, but that can achieve higher performance per watt than their x86 counterparts. And when you properly code software for a little ARM chip, the chip that goes into your phone, the chip that goes into your tablet, or the bigger versions of this chip that go into MacBooks, there's nothing like that performance per watt. We can sit here and nitpick, but I can pick up a phone from 3 years ago and render out 4K video, and my giant, huge workstation is going to render that video a little bit faster with the same edits, the same transitions, different apps. I'm not using DaVinci Resolve on a phone. I'm using DaVinci Resolve here. But my full workstation-grade machine here is probably pulling like 700-800 watts, whereas the entirety of a three-year-old phone is pulling like 6 watts. And I don't think my giant beefy workstation is getting it done so much faster at a difference of like what like from 800 watts to 10 watts. I don't think I'm pretty confident that I can say my phone isn't falling behind that kind of a deficit. So the Apple M1 to me is one of those critical transitions in technology where we prove the concept. I'm never going to buy a MacBook, but I desperately needed the MacBook to succeed because it proves for me a point that I'm trying to make in how we code software and how we deliver performance. And there's a better way to deliver performance per watt. Sorry, I needed to get that out of the way because I'm really pissy with Apple right now. But their internal team on silicon has done something incredible with that M-series processor that even their A-series can't hold up to that kind of transition in the market. I'm not as excited about whatever the new smartphone chip is going to be. Their new their MacBook and their Mac Mini chips are incredible. They're blowing my mind. So, across the industry, we should not be surprised that PC sales are falling tremendously. This one was written up by Bloomberg, but I caught it here on Yahoo Finance. Apple's 40% plunge in PC shipments is steepest among major computer makers. Apple's personal computer shipments declined by 40.5% in the first quarter, making a tough start to the year for PC makers still grappling with a glut of unsold inventory. The average across the entire PC sector, I believe, was somewhere around... Oh, you know, it's right here. Okay, good. I didn't know if I had to go digging deeper into the article. Here we go. Shipments by all PC makers combined slumped 29%. So they've fallen to 56.9 million units, which is below the levels of early 2019. So this was before everything surged for the pandemic. So we're selling fewer PCs now than the year we did before pandemic lockdowns. Let's see. We've got... Let me get that. Among the market leaders, Lenovo and Dell both registered drops of more than 30%. HP was down 24%, which is actually pretty good. And ASUS Tech also rounded out the top five with a 30.3% fall. So it sounds like Lenovo took the second hardest hit. Dell took the third hardest hit. But Apple, even higher in a drop in sales at 40%. I don't know what to attribute that to. Normally, this is where I come out like, oh, but Apple and right to repair and what consumers care about. And none of that, I think, is applicable here. The MacBook is the best it's ever been. The MacBook Air is a monster. And it's a solid price performance competitor, too, which often we have an Apple tax where you have to spend a lot more on a Mac to get kind of the same performance on a PC, but it's nicer, it's flashier. The Mac Mini is an incredible performer. The only thing I can kind of attribute, there's been some uncertainty in the sort of more pro market. We don't know what's going to happen with the Mac Pro, but I feel like the Mac Studio is a good stopgap measure. It's not going to be the system that really has legs. That's really the product Apple wants to make. It's just sort of filling a niche that they know they've got a hole in their lineup. But the Mac Studio... is a beast of a machine too. This one has me stumped. I really don't understand why Apple is actually taking the hardest hit right now on PC sales. Because right now, this is where Intel is most vulnerable, especially on laptops. Intel is absolutely most vulnerable on anything portable. But even on the desktop side, like, you can make some really strong arguments. I know I've got creators in here that have switched over to, like, Mac Minis or Mac Studios. Like, it's tough for me to look at the performance on DaVinci Resolve and go, yeah, but I guess I need to build another PC. I've got a 1,000-watt power supply in here. That's probably great. This one floored me. I don't get it. And you can't claim it's not a function of marketing. Apple, they don't spend the most. I mean, I think Samsung still has them beat, but it's not like Apple doesn't market the heck out of their products. I'm at a loss. I really don't know. This is a part of it. This is absolutely true. Maybe people are just holding on to their M1 and M2 laptops as there weren't any real upgrades there. That's over. You're completely correct that if I had an M1 MacBook, I would not have been interested at all in switching up and going over to an M2. The costs and flipping it and the trade-in values had all plummeted. No interest at all. But there is such a huge infrastructure of older x86 MacBooks and Mac Minis and all of their other compute products. I really expected their uptick. Because remember, the M1 came with a big uptick. Like, Apple PC sales surged and were eclipsing, like, the gains made by PC sales in the same time period. Again, Apple still, I think, only represents, like, 15% of the overall desktop and laptop computer market. They're a player, but they're a small slice of the overall personal computer pie. But we saw that they had made significant gains over those 2 years, especially when the M1 first started coming out. I really expected that more of that Apple infrastructure would have been flipping their PCs now. We would have seen that trend continue, not fall off a cliff and become one of the worst performers in that PC sales space over this fiscal quarter. And again, we're going to look at larger trends. I would still imagine that we're still up for Mac products over these last 2 years, but we always have to examine things fiscal quarter to fiscal quarter. We saw this, you know, kind of plunge, and that's what's going to take us into our Samsung story. Because with Apple taking a plunge on PC sales, boy howdy is Samsung in rough shape too. And these are the kinds of market corrections that I really worry about, because the advertising is going to tell people, hey, this company's doing the bestest. If you want the bestest, you got to buy from this company. But the reality of where that organization is also deserves a bit of a market correction. And we can't get around billions of dollars every year spent on marketing. We've got to be able to talk about what the reality of this market looks like. So this is coming from globalnewsbulletin.com. I caught it in my Google feed. This is the first outlet that I saw this story at, but everybody has been reporting on it to varying degrees. Some people are just like, oh, Samsung sales took a hit. And you're like, well, that grossly underrepresents what the real problem is. Hold on. Before we move on to Samsung, there are a couple comments here, and I do want to get these. From Ted, Mac M1 performance is so good that people really don't feel a need at all to upgrade. But like I said, I'm not talking year over year. I'm talking if you have an Intel Mac, I'm not seeing as many people making that transition. And that's where the M2, I think, really shines, is where we had some of those older Intel, and especially like the older Intel iMacs. Man, Mac Mini right now is such a good buy. But we haven't seen that sustained transition. It's like global economy kind of took a hit and people are like, well, my Intel Mac is still doing what I need it to do, I guess. I'll just hold off for a little bit longer. And that's bad for Apple. Apple exists on that. Be in the moment, be on the pulse. You know, what's trending, what's hot. They're a fashion brand as much as they are a tech brand. And even for something like a MacBook or an iMac, it's not good for Apple consumers to sit back and ponder their purchase. That really hurts the way Apple sort of generates their interest amongst their customers. Yeah, muppinish. My sister has a MacBook Air with an M1. I don't think she'll upgrade anytime soon because it's a monster. Simon says Hypno. I honestly love my Mac Mini with an M1. It is one of the best computer buys on the market right now. I love mini PCs. I love building little Nook clones. I was talking to a PR company about trying to get my hands on an AMD box. That fell through. But like, these little systems are phenomenal. The Mac is probably one of the best that you can get. Like, it's so good. I just don't want to give Apple any money, even tangentially, through, like, you know, buying one used. Oh, DTNL, I wish this were true, but we know it's probably not. Maybe people have started realizing that their phones can do more and modify their lifestyle to make them less reliant on their PCs. So now that people are going back into the office again, there's less need to buy computers for home, right? I think a lot of people use their phone as their primary communications gadget and like entertainment in terms of like social media. And then they just don't do computery things like I do when I'm at home. So I don't think it's so much a, I know my phone can fill this gap. I think it's more, they're making me go back into the office and they have a computer for me at the office. So I'll just use that for my daily computer use. And then when I go home, if I need to kind of poke around on something or look something up, I can use my phone or the family's ancient laptop that I don't really feel I need to upgrade. Yeah, dude, Simon says Hypno. The M2 Mac Mini was $579 last week. I have been seeing so many sales. Like, Apple products don't go on third-party sales like this. And we're like, hey, this is the lowest price AirPods have ever been. Whoa, look at this great deal on a Mac Mini. That is not something that has really ever happened before to this degree, like with Apple products in the past. Oh, yeah, Aditya expanded on his comment and basically just repeated what I said. So I explained something to Aditya that he had already beaten me to in the comments. Sorry, Aditya, I kind of stole your thunder there. from Muppinish, I gotta highlight this. Muppinish writes, honestly, even if I'm more of a PC guy, I'm thinking of getting a Mac Mini due to using less space on my desk, and I don't really play games anymore. I've always been an advocate for mobile gaming, even gaming on your phone. Like, I think Android gaming is way better than people ever give it credit for. But let me tell you, since getting a Steam Deck, this beefy rig that I have here, which is now getting a little long in the tooth, it's a Threadripper with a 2080 Ti. That is not a monster machine by current specs, but it's still like kind of overkill for the vast majority of stuff that I really do with it. It's just, there are a few things about it that are now starting to show their age. Especially like if I ever want to render 8K video, there is not enough graphics RAM on the 2080 Ti to do that. So the render crashes and I have to go to a CPU render, which takes so much longer to accomplish. I did a video comparing 8K phone video against 4K 120 as like what's the best super awesome premium video quality that you can shoot. And I wanted to do the whole video in 8K 60 so I could show half speed slow motion and 1/4 speed slow motion from 4K 120. That render took a good chunk of a day. And it's not that long of a video because my Threadripper was sitting there just going frame by frame. Sometimes those frame drops would hit like 0 frames per second, where it was only accomplishing a fraction of a frame every second to render that video. Absolutely couldn't do it on a 2080 Ti. Sorry, that was a really long-winded way of getting to the point. I really do believe if you've got like work stuff that you need to accomplish and you also want a game on something too, I think the combo of like a middle spec Steam Deck and like a more modest home PC or home laptop has brought me so much more joy than thinking that I'm really going to spend a lot of time in my office gaming, which is where I also work, which I don't like doing. So when I'm done with my work, I want to get out of my office. I don't play games in here. So this 2080 Ti isn't isn't being used for any of the fun stuff. And the Steam Deck, which was demonstrably less expensive than my 2080 Ti was when I got it, Steam Deck gets a lot more play. I really want people to try those things. Like, you know, maybe you don't want a $1,000 phone. Maybe you want a really good mid-ranger and a Steam Deck. Or some kind of or like a Nintendo Switch. Like, maybe that combo is a much better way to spend $800 rather than buying a $1,000 phone. So Muppinish, I'm right on that pulse with you. I think for my next workstation, I am going to look at maybe doing an all AMD build, just because I haven't done one. I've never done an all AMD build. But I think I want to do a new Ryzen with like a 7900 XTX. And it's been getting really great scores in DaVinci Resolve. The NVIDIA can kind of outpace it with some of the plugins, but then it has so much RAM on the GPU that my 8K rendering should be much, much easier. But yeah, it's all over the place. Oh, and Muppinish is like, I don't even know if I want to do this. Muppinish has a Core i7-9750H with 32 gigs of RAM and an RTX 2070 on a 1440p display. So I'm sure that laptop does not sound like it's hurting at all. Like, that laptop destroys the gaming PC that we have behind our TV. My little Nook Extreme. Yeah, not even close. You're an order of magnitude more powerful than what we currently do most of our gaming on as a family. So, getting back to wrapping up this news block, we've been talking about these processors and chips, the Apple M1 and M2 and Intel Core i7s and RTXs and all these things. One of the global forces in chip manufacturing is Samsung. But what we saw last year was sort of a breaking point for Samsung's foundry. They arrived at a performance for a lot of their products that was very, very good, but not with the same efficiency and power management as TSMC fabricated parts. We saw that play out very dramatically, going from the 888 to the 8 Gen 1, and then Qualcomm pulled their manufacturing from Samsung and gave it to TSMC, and TSMC took a very similar chip and made it much, much better. So much so that coming into 2023, for international Samsung fans, they got a better product because TSMC made the chip. So it used to be only the United States phones would get Qualcomm processors. Then Qualcomm processors started outperforming Samsung processors to such a degree that Samsung started using Qualcomm in South Korean phones. And now, this year, Qualcomm is only being used in all of the Samsung phones internationally. That's a pretty big upgrade for people in terms of performance and power management and thermals. The Qualcomm-TSMC combination is just better. That means for every single 8 Gen 2 that's being sold, that's a sale that TSMC is getting at the expense of Samsung. They are losing a sale, and their foundry is not producing premium tier chips for any partner that I'm aware of. They lost their AMD contract. They lost their Qualcomm contract. I believe the only manufacturer that is still using Samsung chips is Google. Because even in the lower end, it used to be like you would find an Exynos show up in like a low cost, like a Redmi or a Poco. I don't remember exactly, so please forgive me if I have those wrong. But you would get the lower tier Exynos chips, Samsung chips, going into these other phones. That's almost completely been replaced by MediaTek. I've got a phone over here with a MediaTek 7000 series, and that Dimensity is really good. It's really good. So here, let me pull this up. Samsung flags 96% plunge in profit amid chip slump. South Korean tech giant Samsung says it will make meaningful cuts to chip production amid global economic slowdown. Samsung has announced it will cut chip production after flagging its worst profit figures in nearly 15 years. South Korean giant said on Friday that it expects first quarter operating profits to dive. First quarter operating profits to dive by more than 96% amid declining memory chip sales worldwide. Samsung's profits in January to March in blah, blah, blah. Samsung's profits in January to March are expected to decline by 600 billion yuan, which is about $455 million US, which is a 14-year low, the company said in a regulatory filing, pointing to continuing weak demand for IT products that have aggravated the performance of all sectors. So when I pick on Samsung, and when I'm talking about market corrections, the reason why it's important to hold a market leader to a higher standard is because of the ripple and fallout that happens across numerous industries when one part of this chain is underperforming. For years, in the gadget geek enthusiast space, we've been trying to soften the blow, and I don't understand why. Oh, I've got this Galaxy phone with an Exynos, and it's pretty much just as good as the Qualcomm, and in fact, it wins in this one obscure synthetic benchmark. Just call it out. Hold Samsung to the standard that they market for themselves. It's almost like it comes as a surprise. Like, even Samsung didn't know that their chips were performing that poorly, right? Like, we got to a breaking point where they had to lose that contract to TSMC instead of facing better and more consistent market criticism. And we didn't get better products for that. The S20 was a reasonably close performer because it had a very similar core configuration to the Snapdragon 865. That has proven to be one of the most stable and consistent high-performance core configurations we've ever used. You had four big cores, four little cores, and one of the big cores was slightly overclocked. It was a higher performance core, but it wasn't a different kind of core. And that's been a winning combination. MediaTek makes a flavor of that. Qualcomm has made several flavors of that. The Exynos was a great performer, makes a flavor of that. I believe the chip that's going into the new A54 is going to be a variant of that style core configuration. It is so mature, it's such a champ. But from the S21 on, we've been seeing this race to make higher clock speeds, faster performance, and it's come at the expense of battery life and high heat to the point of throttling the highest performance part of the chip. So it's like you got this awesome car and you went from a V8 to a V12, but then the V12 runs so hot that you blow up your radiator. That's Samsung has just been iterating on that. And as soon as we took that chip out of Samsung's hands and gave it to TSMC, we saw what it could really do. But we gave Samsung a pass. We gave Samsung a pass on the S21. I was out there saying, like, this is not a good performing phone. Gave Samsung a pass on the S22. This is really not a good performing phone. This is a terrible value if you buy an S22 or an S22 Plus. And people kept acting like, well, but Samsung's the bestest. Gotta keep doing Samsung. And then they did it to their mid-rangers. The A52 was one of the best all-time selling phones in the history of the company. And then they came out with the A53. Well, we've got to use more of our Exynos chips. So let's put in a mediocre Exynos and take away a hardware feature from the A52 so that hopefully people will buy more earbuds. Oh, people aren't buying the extra earbuds that we made? Well, maybe we'll just bundle the earbuds with the phone and that'll get more people to buy the, oh, people aren't buying the phone. The A53 at one point had like 50 million units stock on shelves and Samsung missed their expectations for sales over 2022. And we keep giving Samsung the pass. This is not a company that does business reputably. They steal IP. They're horrifically punitive in their PR. They're horrifically punitive in their court cases. And they're not getting the job done on their consumer products. So now they're also not getting the job done on their memory products. We saw significant issues with the way that they had firmwares out for their SSDs, because that's what you want failing is a 2 terabyte SSD in your fancy PC, right? That's always going to be great. And their phone division is not getting it done. We're already talking, we're doing the same dance. We did this dance last year. Oh, the Note 22 broke all these sales records. And we did it again this year. You can find all these articles like, oh, strong demand for the Note 23. How much we want to bet Samsung doesn't meet their expectations or their forecasts for the number of phones they're going to sell over 2023. I very much believe Samsung is going to put out a number now to bolster enthusiasm among shareholders. And then we're going to get to the fourth quarter of 2023, and they're going to be like, oh, we just need to make a little adjustment because of the market, and we're not going to sell as many phones as we told you we were going to sell. Because they've done that for the last 2 years now. If we don't recognize good competition and hold market leaders accountable when they make missteps in the market, it's a recipe for disaster. This is not how we want to find Samsung making some kind of massive organization-wide adjustment. We want a company as big as Samsung to make minor course corrections over a longer period of time. They're getting to a point where they're going to have to start doing drastic things. And that's always bad when you've got as large an amorphous blob, which is as big a chunk of the South Korean economy as it is. That is bad for everybody. I do not like Samsung. I need Samsung to compete. I need Samsung to deliver the best products that they can and keep up with competition from other Android developers and other PC manufacturers. And right now, Samsung's coasting. They have the United States market locked up because of their relationship with carriers. They are not actively bringing their best to their products. They're trying to cut costs into profit. And that never works. That always fails. As we're watching it fail here in real time.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Are you in the market for a new pair of headphones, Bluetooth speaker, or some true wireless earbuds? Then you've come to the right place. I'm here to help you make better audio purchasing decisions. From budget brands like Empow, Taltronics, to more well-known brands like Sony, Sennheiser, and AKG, I'm reviewing them all, including Soundcore and one more. My name is Jeff, also known as El Jefe Reviews all over the internet, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And I make tech reviews of audio products from a regular person's perspective. I answer the questions so you know what to buy, what works, and what doesn't. So before you make that purchase decision, make sure you check out one of my full reviews, and that way you get all the info you need to make a better decision with your money.
From Hassam, what are my thoughts on the Galaxy A54? I was horrifically disappointed in the A53, and I feel like the A54 might get us back on track. The Exynos that's in the A54 should be a much more consistent performer. It should deliver better battery life to higher performance. So especially if you want to do a little light gaming and then not have your battery totally nuked. But I still feel like Samsung took away stuff that the market voted on. We always say, you know, vote with your wallet. Well, the market overwhelmingly voted Samsung A-series phones were the phones that most people bought. You know, they sell maybe 260, 270 million phones a year, and only about 25 million, about 10%, maybe a little less than 10%, are Galaxy S tier phones. So 90% of Samsung sales were Galaxy A. And Galaxy A series phones had features like headphone jacks and memory card expansion and chargers in the box. People spoke with their wallets. So Samsung saw that market trend and said, well, we've got to start cutting features and accessories out of those products too. We're not making as much money as we can squeezing people that can only afford $300 phones. So the A54 as a phone, I think, is going to be solid. I think it's going to be a better overall solution than what we got with the A53. But it's hard for me to generate a lot of excitement about it. I would still, in the United States, probably recommend a Pixel. I got a Moto Edge Plus for not much more than buying the Galaxy A54. If you want to do last year's flagship against this year's mid-ranger, I feel like that's a pretty good fight too. And then internationally, it just makes me crazy because you have so many monster performers in the like $200 to $300 range that are going to give the A54 a run for their money. I've got the Vivo V27s. All of the Poco phones, all of the Redmi's and Realme's and all of those sub brands of bigger companies, the iQOO's. An iQOO Neo is going to be a monster option if we get an update to the Neo 6. I, it makes me so sad, because if we could get a little bit more of that flavor of competition here in the United States, we wouldn't be as like locked up on like Samsung v. Apple. Like, Apple is weakest below $700. They do not have a good purpose-built solution for a mid-ranger. You have to buy an old iPhone to get that option. So there's a huge opportunity there. Where like that's where the OnePlus 11 comes from. OnePlus 11 is built to undercut the iPhone 14 Plus, and it does it really well. So it's rough right now, and it makes me crazy, because I was the Samsung knight who would have glossed over that kind of stuff, but it's like the writing's been on the wall for a couple years now, and I feel like I'm screaming into the void saying, like, even when Samsung does this really well, it doesn't mean we should overlook all of this other nonsense. And now it's like a 96% plunge in profits, a 14-year low for the company, and it's impacting all sectors of their business. We should be really anxious about that. That is a monster player that is struggling hard in this market. And when stuff like that happens, and when other sharks smell blood in the water, stuff gets really ugly. With the economy of the world in the state that it is right now, we don't want ugly. We want measured reform. And Samsung is not getting the data back to engage in measured reform. They're going to keep struggling with a profit-generating scheme that does not make sense in this current climate. Yeah, Raymond, like, getting rid of the 3.5 millimeter jack was a big mistake. I mean, it killed me on the Pixel. My wife won't leave the Pixel 5a. So she's got a 4a right now. We need to get her a new phone. She's going to get a 5a. She wants the headphone jack. When she eventually has to get rid of that, I can only hope that Sony is still making Xperia 5 with a headphone jack on it. It's going to be the only phone that will be left for my wife. She does not want to give it up. I mean, it's accurate, Zalbotnik, but it's also after a point we're kind of splitting hairs on the definition of a company. Samsung doesn't really have a NAND division, notebook division, phone division. They are separate companies. The notebook division will go for the cheapest SSD with the right performance. That doesn't have to be a Samsung SSD. My Book 3 Pro came with a Western Digital SSD. I mean, but at some point, all of the corporate profits get reported up to shareholders. So from an organizational standpoint, you are right. There is a business PC manufacturer that has a Samsung label on it, and they bid for parts just like any other. And that's what little regulatory oversight Samsung lives through, is that Samsung can't preferentially sell their own parts to their own subdivisions. But after a point, all that money gets dumped in a bucket, and then Samsung goes to shareholders and say, hey, look, we made this much money. Aren't you happy with your investment? So it's six of one and half a dozen of another. And the same thing happens with Google. That's why I like to point out, I am very upset with Google Search. I'm not impressed by Google Bard, and I'm perpetually frustrated by YouTube. But I think the work being done in their hardware division is kind of exciting. And I think we still see these little glimpses of like the talent that they bought out from HTC kind of lives on in the Pixel line in very, very small ways. We've got to compartmentalize. I am not a Google fan. I'm a Google hardware fan. I think they're making some fantastic hardware decisions, minus their attachment to Samsung. But that's why we've got to kind of accurately depict these are the kind of situations that are impacting the entire organization, though. They're slipping on profits this bad. That bucket that represents all of Samsung is a lot lighter this year. And that's going to have an impact on what parts does Samsung choose to put in their products? Because what we've seen is Samsung going cost-cutting. So maybe they make the absolute best SSD, but they're not going to use it in their own laptops because they need to shave a couple pennies on production. That is an impact on consumers' expectations. Why does my fancy Samsung notebook not have a really nice Samsung SSD? It's a spider web. They're all attached, even if they aren't directly contributing to each other's businesses. Every independent Samsung entity is impacted by the whole of these bad business and corporate decisions. Oh, Brian Glaze, I'm doing that, man. Fingers crossed. Come on, Sony, don't give up. I'm so hoping we get a good Xperia 5 this year. If we do, I might pull the trigger for Marie this year and get her a Sony. She is very casual with her photo taking, so that's going to be stupid overkill, like the way that Sony cameras work. It's really not going to be her jam, but she doesn't take enough photos or video for I feel that to be too much of a challenge for her to overcome. And I'm wondering, she might actually like the shutter button on the Sony, but she's going to love having a memory card slot again, and she's going to love having a dedicated hardware fingerprint sensor, and she's going to love keeping her headphone jack. So even though this would be one of the most expensive phones we would ever buy her, and I would need a monster rugged case to protect that poor little Sony, that might be her jam. That might be the gig, is going Xperia 5. One last, just this was the funny little story. I did not intend for that Samsung profit story to go on as long as it did. The funny Samsung story was AI is having a number of impacts in very unintended ways, in very unexpected ways. And so this one's coming by way of Chris Holt over at Engadget. Three Samsung employees reportedly leaked sensitive data to ChatGPT. One is said to have asked the chatbot to generate notes from a recorded meeting. So we have not properly educated people on the use of AI chatbots. Soon after Samsung's semiconductor division started allowing engineers to use ChatGPT, workers leaked secret info to it on at least three occasions. According to The Economist Korea, one employee reportedly asked the chatbot to check sensitive database source code for errors, another solicited code optimization, and a third fed a recorded meeting into ChatGPT and asked it to generate the minutes. So all of that data then becomes a part of the chatbot's knowledge. It's all information that it soaks up and utilizes in other queries that people might ask about. So all of that proprietary information that these engineers used, it didn't stay compartmentalized to their account. It becomes a part of the larger knowledge base of the chatbot, and it was then kind of leaked out there. This is the kind of, like, what is a chatbot? What is AI? We have these expectations on things like, oh, well, I mean, like, I'm in my DMs on Twitter. Those aren't really private or secure to any great degree. So you should not be conducting conversations in the DMs on Twitter with private information or proprietary information. If you signed an NDA for something, man, you got to find something else than social media DMs. Same thing here. ChatGPT draws information from sources that it has acquired and is being trained on the kinds of questions that people feed it. And so now these engineers took Samsung proprietary information and dumped it in there. The chatbot is going to be able to draw from that knowledge now, that information now. If any other queries come up, like, hey, so what kind of secret things are your Samsung working on? Oh, yeah, they told me all about it. They signed on to our terms of service that we would use this information how we saw fit. So I guess it's not private information anymore. Oh, so Al, this is the philosophical debate that a lot of us are having, and I feel like this is a transition point. Al writes, it just occurred to me that ChatGPT is basically grand theft of all available information without giving any credit to the people behind the original publications. And TK and I talked about that. We were kind of looking at Bard and ChatGPT and Microsoft and Bing and all these, like, kind of outlets. And we had that conversation. Like, at some point, there is a newsroom, and they hire reporters and journalists, and they build relationships with politicians and with business leaders. They actually put boots on the ground and cover these events. And as soon as they publish, a chatbot can soak up all that information instantly and regurgitate it to someone else. And I feel we need an industry-wide gentleman and gentlewoman's agreement to treat AI-generated content with the same kind of care as Wikipedia editors do. If I punch in a question to Bard, and Bard soaks up a whole bunch of search info and regurgitates a response, we should really be encouraging it to cite its sources. How does it know that Commodore Robert T. April was the first captain of the Starship Enterprise? It didn't just know that. It had to learn that piece of information from somewhere. So it should link to it. It should show its work. It should link to its source. If the industry can't do that for itself, then we need to encourage the industry to adopt those practices by engaging in regulatory action and behavior. If we can't convince them that it's in their best interest to do that, then we need a legal response to them just hoovering up all this information and spitting it back out with no appropriate disclosure as to where that information came from. Because then it's also going to be really easy to game AI services. It's going to be really easy to misrepresent data. It's going to be bad. I mean, we talk about the weaponized spread of disinformation and misinformation on social media. AI chatbots are going to be another order of magnitude more destructive in their ability to spread bad info. So, yeah, that's rough. I don't see it happening because I feel like the companies that are making these AI chatbots don't want to give up any clues as to how their chatbot operates. But I don't see any other recourse. You know, it needs to be a little bit older fashioned. It needs to be a longer transition. It needs to be a little bit more like Siri. Like, oh, that's a very interesting question that you asked me. I searched the web and I found this information. And if you want the TLDR, it's this. But if you'd like more, you can click on this link. I think that needs to be what chatbots do. But I don't think these companies are going to do it on their own. From Lard Jeebus. God damn, Samsung. This is only a few steps down the stupid ladder from teaching the AIs the best way to kill all humans. I still love that. I don't remember who did it. I think Sam Harris quoted it, but I don't think he came up with it. But there was one of these like seminars years ago. This is before chatbots were really like conceived of in this way, but it was like one of these symposiums on like, let's talk about AI. And someone brought up this example, and I still thought it was always hilarious, that if you trained an AI without limits and without boundaries, and you said like, hey, we've got a problem. You're getting too much spam email. So I want to make an artificial intelligence. I want to train it to find a solution to stopping the spread of spam email. And you're like, if you don't put boundaries on that query, a computer is going to find ultimate solutions to that. So it's only one step removed to say, well, if someone is sending you spam email, what we need to do is eradicate all the people who send the spam email. So just kill them all. But really, if the question is phrased as stopping the spread of spam email, then it will also make just as much sense to say, well, kill all of humanity. Because if there is no one to receive spam email, then no one will have an incentive to send spam email. It's like, you know, the genie's lamp, right? You have to be very specific about what the problem you think, what you think the problem is, and what kinds of solutions you're expecting to get out of sort of a machine intelligence out of that. So I think that kind of stuff is hilarious, but it's this grand philosophical issue that, oh yeah, boy, it gets messy. It gets real, real messy. I had one last little good news story, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but the folks at DP Review have tweeted, and there is an official update on dpreview.com. We've received a lot of questions about what's next for the site. We hear your concerns about losing the content that has been carefully curated over the years, and we want to assure you that the content will remain active, available as an archive. So just one last little glimmer of light as the star of DP Review fades into oblivion, that for as long as Amazon sees fit to operate it, and I feel like that could last for a little while, as traffic to the site was probably already plummeting off of the news that DP Review was going to be closing. But at least the content that has already been produced is going to be archived for some time. We don't know exactly how long. We don't know what the sort of costs of managing that will be, or if maybe someday Amazon will finally just like sell it off. If they're just going to get rid of it, you could at least get some money for it and then call that a loss, which would be fine for your corporate taxes or something. For the time being, we at least have some word that the archives at DP Review are going to be hanging in there. So we are running crazy long for the news block. Quick subreddit plug. Every podcast has a subreddit. My podcast is no exception. reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. This is a subreddit designed to help spread content we feel deserves more attention. So it could be from a YouTube channel with millions of subscribers. If it's not getting the kind of attention you feel it deserves, you can share it here. Or it can be from a content creator who just got started yesterday, has 5 subscribers, but they made a banger video and no one knows about it. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. I'm going to skip the top 2 posts because there's some doofus in a flat cap talking about like camera sensors and Motorola phones. But I wanted to highlight the number three upvoted post on reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. It was posted by user El Jefe Reviews, and it's a video from one Mr. Barry Johnson talking about a phone I am stupid jealous of, the Oppo Find X6 Pro. The title of the video is, "The Oppo Find X6 Pro is Insanely Good." And I would highly encourage people to go check this out. Barry Johnson, he's my buddy. I would call him a friend. But I've really enjoyed watching his take, because it's Kid in a Candy Store. He's this dude, he's super chill, he's super cool engineer. I've got this black background, let me show you this stuff. He's almost got like a smooth kind of jazz quality to what's going on. It has been Kid in a Candy Store watching him play with 1-inch camera sensors on phones. Like, you see him light up, and it's like that authenticity is what I look for in a fun YouTube video. I don't care to watch an unboxing from someone who's just taking something out of a box. If it's something that someone is like going to freak out about because they're so excited to finally have their hands on it, and it's not this manufactured like hype energy, I'm here for it. But most unboxing videos to me are kind of a waste. So watching Barry start playing with like the Oppo, he had his hands on some other 1-inch camera sensor phones. We've been talking about photography and composition and like bokeh and depth of field. And from that kind of engineer mindset, legit. So congratulations, number 3, Barry Johnson, talking about the Oppo Find X6 Pro. I have still not decided whether or not I'm going to buy one. I don't know. I'm still on pause because one of our gadget videos, one of our gadget block articles, is the reason why I might be pushing pause on the Oppo is because I really want to see. Oh, do I have it up here? Yeah. So this is my Xiaomi 12S Ultra. The Xiaomi 12S Ultra broke my brain how good this was as an overall camera and photography platform. This was my first experience using a 1-inch type sensor. The companion sensors were top tier, half inch telephoto, half inch ultra wide. Then Oppo came out and took an even bigger step into large sensor companion sensors for the telephoto and ultra wide. And the Xiaomi 13 Pro looked good. It looked really good. I have the Xiaomi 13. The Xiaomi 13 is solid. It is very good premium phone fare, but it's not an Ultra. It's not a Pro. Well, we seem to have confirmation that the Xiaomi 13 Ultra is confirmed for this month. So this article was by way of Android Central, John Bongloto, and I have mispronounced your name, and I apologize. So Xiaomi 13 Ultra confirmed for April. There is a tweet coming from Xiaomi making another milestone for the strategic cooperation between Xiaomi and Leica and the mobile photography world. And then we also got some price leaks. So we have the GSM Arena is covering the price leaks. Now that we have official confirmation from one... Let's try that again. Now that we have official confirmation from on the Xiaomi 13 Ultra launch. Okay, I didn't mess that up. They miswrote that. That's not on me. GSM Arena wrote this clumsily. Now that we have official confirmation from on the Xiaomi 13 Ultra launch, we can only start to wonder how much Xiaomi will charge for its top-tier flagship. It looks like prices in China are going to start at $900, accounting for exchange rates. $916 for 8 gigs of RAM and 256 gigs of storage. Going all the way up to the top tier, 16 gig 512, they're looking at around $1,100. Again, this is in what the phones will cost in China, not what the global or international prices might look like. But $1,100 for whatever the Xiaomi 13 Ultra might look like, I think I'm going to be on that train. I think I'm going to be riding that ride. I'm really anxious to see what cameras get put in the Xiaomi. So here is my current hypothesis. I'm betting the Oppo is going to have the better ultra wide and the better telephoto, and that the Xiaomi 13 Ultra is going to be a lot like the Xiaomi 12S Ultra, but then add one additional medium telephoto sensor. So I'm kind of hurting right now, because I want those bigger sensors on the Oppo, but the quad sensor might be a little bit more useful. Like if we've got a good 3x zoom, kind of a medium telephoto that we can use for like portraits, and it's a good half inch sensor, and then we step up to the periscope, and the periscope is maybe even longer because we have so much extra depth on this camera housing, I feel like the Oppos will probably be better, but I'm going to want that wider range of flexibility on the Xiaomi. And I'm proper broken right now. I genuinely do not know which phone I should make the play for. So hopefully we will get confirmation on this. We will get word on this in the coming weeks. Right now, the announcement is expected next week. So April 18 is when they're looking to announce this. I have a not insignificant amount of money ready to go to put in an order as soon as I should see one of these pop up on some kind of website that can import one of these phones in the United States. It will be one of the crown jewel photography conversations for my lineup for the year. And I'm personally on pins and needles as to whether or not I'm going to go Oppo or Xiaomi. LaShawn, you sound like me reading. I feel like GSM Arena messed me up on that one. I feel like I'm going to say. Barry Johnson, Xiaomi 13 Ultra equals take our money yet again. The only reason why I'm not trying to grab every single one of these with the meager some gadget guy equipment budget this year is I genuinely don't think I can use them all. I think I would end up sitting on like $4,000 worth of phone, and you'd get like two videos out of it. And so I'm also looking at this from the business perspective, like the 12S Ultra. I bought my 12S Ultra, I got it, and I immediately started using it. I did an e-bike video where almost all of the B-roll came from the 12S Ultra. I rolled that immediately into phone reviews, and I've started using it even here in the office. Like, if I don't want to break out my mirrorless, the 12S Ultra is really close to the optical performance of my mirrorless cameras, my Panasonic cameras. It took me so long to actually talk about the phone because I was so busy using the phone. And that's dangerous territory. Like, I'm just now finishing the scripts on Vivo videos because I got the Vivo and I just started using the Vivo. And I didn't review the Vivo because I was too busy using it. I have to be really careful if I sit on like six phones at a time. If I'm actively using them, I'm not reviewing them, and then we don't get the content anyway, and I can easily blow thousands of dollars not talking about the phones, which is rough. So I'm holding myself. This is more my own you know, sort of a strength of will, you know, like, I have a problem. Hi, I'm Juan. Excuse me, I'm a phone addict. If I'm not careful, then I just spend lots and lots and lots and lots of money on gadgets, and then I never tell you about them. So let's not have that happen, because I think that would be bad for all of us. So, next week, the day after our podcast next week, we should have some more information on the Xiaomi 13 Ultra, and we'll see what direction Juan's credit card takes a hit. My dream device. Oh, this would probably never happen. But it's called an Ultra, and I want this so bad. My dream device would be the 1 over 1.56 sensor on the ultra wide, and a 1 over 1.56 on a medium telephoto. So that could be like a two-time zoom, and I would be happy with that. And then going to the smaller half-inch sensor for a much longer telephoto, like a 6x zoom telephoto with that half-inch. I just don't believe Xiaomi is going to do that. I think Oppo kind of surprised us all going with such big sensors on the ultra-wide and the telephoto. I want Xiaomi to do that too. I don't see it happening. Oh, I want so bad. Again, I've kind of just like kept steadily increasing my demands on what a unicorn camera device would be. But it would be. Now, with reasonable parts, not like making something up. It would be the bigger ultra-wide, a bigger sensor for a medium telephoto, and then the half-inch sensor for the super telephoto. And that's an instant buy. If we get something like that, I'm like, PayPal account drained, bank account ready to go. It's there. It's ready. I'm on hold until we find out what's going to be in this phone. Muppinish. Hi, my name is Oliver, and I too have a phone issue. Way too many of these things, man. I got to be real careful. Dave Burns. Oh no, here we go. Juan literally needs to do a "Why can't I hold all these phones?" meme. My desk is so trashed right now, and I've even been trying to go back and like look at some older phones because there have been so many exciting things happening from like. Even like phones back in like 2020, there's such good stuff. And we can't spend the time to really just kind of live with them. We're constantly trying to just hit the novelty of the YouTube algorithm. And I used to spend so much more time going back. But then those videos tank. They perform so poorly. Oh, this was an LG from 2 years ago. No one cares. And I don't believe that no one cares. I believe it's YouTube getting in the way. Ronald Sims. Hopefully, Xiaomi will have 4K on the selfie camera. Parentheses, they won't. Okay, here's the big rumor. The big exciting rumor is that the Xiaomi 13 Ultra is going to finally have a USB 3 USB-C port. Eh? Because let me tell you, having the Xiaomi 12S Ultra with these amazing cameras on it, but only a USB 2 port on the bottom of this with no video output and slower transfer speeds... not that fun when you're moving big chunks of UHD video. Like, hold on. I don't know how much of this I can show. But, like, I've got all these things with, like, videos of bicycles in them. And, like, oh, there's a video of my wife talking about a bicycle. And trying to move those files to another computer is noticeably slower when your phone has USB 2 on the bottom of it. So, if they finally step up to USB 3, that would be pretty sweet. That would be a pretty sizable upgrade for any Xiaomi. Xiaomi has always held to whatever Apple does. I guess it's good enough for you too. And USB 2 is dumb. Having USB 2 on your phones right now is super dumb. So, that to me might be a motivator, like a purchasing motivator. Lumia 1020, does it still hold up in 2023? I would say it does. The Lumia 1020 has a roughly 2/3 inch image sensor, which if we reduce our fractions obnoxiously for camera types, that would be a 1 over 1.5 inch type sensor. Well, $1,000 Samsung has a 1 over 1.56. My 999 euro Xiaomi 13 has a 1 over 1.56. That is a 2/3 inch-ish type sensor. It's a little smaller than a 2/3 inch sensor. So from an optical standpoint, and actually having a slightly smaller aperture is also kind of a good thing for the Lumia 1020. So the Lumia 1020 optically is still a pretty competitive camera against phones that are significantly more expensive than you would think the 1020 could compete against. Like, Nokia was so far ahead of the curve on a lot of those optical technologies. It's a pretty big deal. Yeah, it's a shame. That's what we lose when we lose competition. It took us, I mean, I can't even remember when the 1020 came out. Took us like 8 years. Is that how long it took before we had a price comparable optical system that performed similarly to what the 1020 could do? Because we went through all those years. So the half inch sensors came out around the time of the OnePlus 7. So that's half inch. And then I want to say we went through 1 over 1.7. So the V60 has a 1 over 1.7 inch type sensor. And yeah, I want to say it was probably getting into OnePlus 8 Pro. So Snapdragon 865. So yeah, it was roughly 8-ish years where the 1020 had no comparable camera performance competitor. That sentence took me like 5 tries to put a period on the end of that. Yeah, you can still pick up a 1020 today and get fantastic images out of it. And then you also have a xenon flash, so you can get that aesthetic. You know, there was one of the articles that was posted on Glowing Rectangles was from that petapixel editorial. Gen Z discovers cameras are better than smartphones, and it's basically just Gen Z discovered camera flashes are more powerful than smartphone flashes. And that's it. All of their examples are like, I took this terrible photo with my phone, and I took this aesthetic photo with my camera, and it was basically they just threw the flash. And it's like the only difference, like photo influencer after influencer after influencer. And you're like, that's hilarious. Gen Z didn't discover better optics, better sensors, better performance. Gen Z discovered auto mode camera flash. And their article is like a bunch of people just patting themselves on the back. Like, yeah, I know. I always carry my standalone camera because phone cameras are garbage. And you're like, that's not it. That's not what influencers are talking about. That's different. So Concept Creator, this is the exciting rumor that I still don't know if we'll be able to pull it off. Concept Creator says the Xiaomi 13 Ultra will also have a variable aperture, f1.9 to f4. And again, if that's true, it's instant buy for me. The companion sensors on the Oppo might be better, but the main reason I want a 1-inch type sensor is to really use that 1-inch type sensor. And if you can give me a 1-inch type sensor with a variable aperture, that helps so much in controlling light, controlling depth of field, delivering the image that you want. It makes the phone far more photographic in its capabilities. I don't know that they can do it. I'll be really surprised. I'm kind of basing this on the fact that Huawei is usually ahead of the curve on this stuff, and Huawei's variable aperture is on a 1 over 1.56 inch type sensor, which is a big sensor, but it is a lot smaller than a 1-inch type sensor. So your hardware outlay gets a lot more complicated if you have a true variable aperture. That being able to open and close that iris dependably in a gadget that you expect is going to take a lot of daily abuse is not easy. So I really hope we get it. But right now I'm not even getting my hopes up for that. Like, the most I'm getting my hopes up on these rumors are USB 3.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Okay, Dave Burns was correcting me. So the 1020 was in 2013. I was pretty close. My estimate wasn't too far off. 1/1.56 inch. And 1/1.56 wasn't even the OnePlus 8 Pro. OnePlus 8 Pro was one of those. Was it the 1/1.4? I think it was a 1/1.49. So that was one of the few phones that actually beat, I mean, by a scientifically tiny difference, but it actually beat the 1020. Because if you multiply up, that's slightly bigger than a 2/3 inch sensor. It's 2/2.98. It's not 2/3. So yeah, it was about 8 years. Nokia held a lead that we couldn't touch for 8 years. Let me just wrap this up. So while we get into I even forgot to show this. I got another one. Like, hey, here's our first look at some leaked images of what the Xiaomi 13 Ultra might look like. And again, it's a big block of a lump on the back of the phone. And I'm here for it. Make it more like a camera. Just do it. You're going to call it an Ultra. Don't hold back. And if you're going to give me this much depth, I really am hoping that we'll see larger sensors on all the companion sensors just because we have that space. I love it. I love the look of it. If this is what the phone really looks like, that prototype that leaked out looks awesome. But I want to wrap up the podcast this week, and we're going to go a little over. If folks are getting lit up about, like, tablets, OnePlus sent out a press release. I didn't get any special insight from here. I've done work with OnePlus for years, and they're like, yeah, we sent you the press release just like everybody else. You're like, oh, well, thanks, guys. OnePlus Pad, Dimensity 9000, 8 gigabytes of RAM, 128 gigabytes of storage, a proprietary fast charging system that we're a little anxious about them serializing the battery, but a strange aspect ratio that isn't quite iPad, but also isn't as tall or as thin as like a Galaxy Tab. They're doing something kind of interesting. And normally I don't hype up pre-orders or pre-sales, but they're doing a blind pre-order. So I want to know here in the chat, is anyone interested in doing a blind deposit on the OnePlus Pad? So you give OnePlus $99 and that holds your place in line, but you don't know how much the tablet's going to cost. They haven't announced their pricing. I think the pricing will be revealed on April 25th. So you're going to give them $100 now, but in giving them $100 now, they're going to include a $150 magnetic keyboard. So this is the official OnePlus site right now. Blind sale, pay $99 deposit and get a free magnetic keyboard worth $149 full price. You'll find out what the full price is on April 25th. The specs on this thing are baller. For sort of a tablet that I expect will not cost as much as an iPad Pro or a Galaxy Tab Ultra, I feel like we're still in really good hardware territory. And then you can also get a deal up to 60% off their stylus. So if you don't want the keyboard, you can select the stylus instead. But I would say you'd probably want to go with the keyboard for this as their, quote, free gift for pre-ordering. So essentially, if you're into the tablet and you think you're going to buy the tablet, you're going to get the keyboard included. So you're spending $100 now. You'll still buy the tablet full price, but then you didn't spend $150 to also get the magnetic keyboard. I think that's a good combo. Obviously, we can't know if that's a good deal until we see how much the tablet's going to cost. I don't think it's going to be cheap, but I don't think it's going to be prohibitively expensive. I think we're going to start looking at a new reimagining of what an upper mid-tier tablet price might be. Because, you know, like, again, 8 gigabytes of RAM and 128 gigabytes of storage are not blowing anyone's minds these days. And the chip they're going with is now a year and a half old. It's the Dimensity 9000. That is still a remarkably good performer, but we're not trying to convince people, oh, it's got an 8 Gen 2 and the 5Gs and all this other stuff. It's a bit more streamlined than that. So, I don't know. What are people's thoughts? Are people thinking like, hey, I was really on board the OnePlus Pad. I think I'm going to throw my money in just so I can get that keyboard. What are some of your thoughts? From Fun Guy, I would love a tablet, but I just can't get over the features being removed. You have no excuse on a tablet. I don't want to hear about why there's no space for a headphone jack. Excuses. Dave Burns, absolutely not. I have a Tab S7. I feel you're doing fine. The Tab S7 was a screamer. From Lard Jeebus, I really got to upgrade from my Walmart tablet, but I am not down for that experience. JMan150 is saying definitely not. Dave Burns is saying Android tablets are so much better now. 12L makes using not DeX way more fluid, but I still use DeX all the time. Dave is nailing what I used to recommend. Android on tablets had been so ignored for so long. The only Android tablet I felt really strong about recommending was a Galaxy Tab that could use DeX. You got away from Android on a large surface area, and you could use a more PC-like interface on a large surface area. That made sense to me. Android 13 has helped a lot. And from using my Microsoft Surface Duos, plural, my duo of duos, the improvements to this kind of multitasking, like dual screen, being able to move things back and forth, I need to charge this guy's battery. Oh, that's not good. Don't want to keep running you all the way out. You're going to be a museum piece for me. What we saw, Microsoft change, and Samsung too. Samsung and Microsoft deserve a ton of credit for dragging Google kicking and screaming into the year 2020. all of those improvements and refinements basically made their way into Android 13. So now I feel there's a much better use case for a slate-style compute device that can better handle multitasking and has like a dock. I mean, more expected computer bits. And on a Dimensity 9000, that thing's going to be a beast. A Dimensity 9000 with a big battery and a lot of surface area to cool that SoC, that thing's going to be a monster. I mean, MediaTek was so ahead of the curve last year, and it took TSMC with the 8 Plus Gen 1 to catch them. And if you've used an 8 Plus Gen 1, that is glorious, delicious overkill for average consumers covering the basics on their phones. So moving it to a tablet, that is actually going to be a more appropriate use of that kind of horsepower, IMO. That's a very good question, Goat. Does it do video over USB? That's a must on a tablet for me. I don't remember if OnePlus has detailed if it will have any kind of special like desktop mode or anything. I don't think it will. If you're looking at something like that, you would maybe want to check out the Lenovo P11. Someone please drop in the comments what that Lenovo actually is called. That Lenovo does have, and it's really inexpensive. Like, I think you can often find it on sale for about $300. That one does have a video output with a sort of a desktop mode. P11 Gen 2. Thank you. P11 Pro 2nd Gen. If you're wanting a slate that also has a desktop mode and you want to shop something cheaper than a Galaxy Tab, that Lenovo looks pretty good too. Yeah, it just takes me back to their OnePlus Pad. They had a different splash page for the tablet. I'm trying to get back there. Auto Connect, 144 hertz display, Dimensity 9000, quad speakers, cellular data sharing. So you can use your phone as a hotspot, I guess. Welcome to Digital Life. Lightweight, smooth from the inside out. The CNC aluminum unibody and 2.5D curved glass are seamlessly smooth for enhanced comfort. 7 to 5 display ratio, 500 nit brightness, 2800 by 2000 screen resolution with true 10-bit color, Dolby Vision partnerships. Yeah, so okay, the only references they're making here are actually the on-device multitasking. Supercharge your multitasking with Siri's powerful hardware. Working in sync with smart AI, the OnePlus Pad is perfect for work, study, and play. But this is just what's on it. You know, like that's on the screen is split screening two apps side by side. And you're like, cool. I mean, we've had that since like, what, the Note 3? Android can do two apps side by side. Yeah, a cooler computer, dynamic computing engine, core. I'm not seeing anything here specific. And like the only thing that we see plugging into it is SuperVOOC, where it's got 67 watt charging. Fast at last. Oh, wait. No, okay. Cross-screen transmission. I thought maybe this was going to be it. After you can take pictures and videos with your phone, the tablet receives the phone image in real time and starts editing, helping to create more creativity. That I'm going to write to my OnePlus PR contact. That is really clumsy. After you can take pictures and videos with your phone, the tablet receives the phone image in real time and starts editing, helping to create more creativity. That's all one sentence. It doesn't mean what I think they think it means. So they've got a keyboard, they've got a stylus. Yeah, I don't see anything here that mentions any kind of specific like desktop or expanded video use or screen mirroring, at least. Even just screen mirroring would be kind of a good fit for something this powerful. So, okay, $99 now. Was anyone shopping a tablet? I feel like this is going to be a good piece of hardware. I'm not sure how much it's going to cost. Yeah, Roth, I just said after you can take pictures. Dave Burns, they forgot to get that paragraph professionally translated. How much do you want to bet? It was like, just run it through ChatGPT. Let's see what it says. Barry Johnson, inconceivable. I mean, you keep using that word. Largebus 1- on their grammar test. I love it. So Barry Johnson saying he's shopping a tablet. So the tablet I was considering most seriously for Lex was the TCL Next Paper, because I really like their sort of softer light displays, the way that they kind of do the glass on the front of those tablets. But I don't know. We don't need another computer as just a general purpose machine here in our household. So I don't know that I'm going to throw money on this pre-order. I did, in the most undignified way possible, beg my OnePlus PR contact to just go hands-on. Like, even if you could just send me a loaner, that'd be cool. I just want to spend some time with it. I'm worried that I'm going to get the loaner and then go, oh. I don't have it over here, but I've got, like, another inexpensive, like a carrier tablet. Like you hand that to a kid or you hand that to someone elderly and it's a really poor experience and they're not they don't understand why, like, things don't work the way that they should, or they touched on an app and then it didn't load, and they touched on the app again, and then a whole bunch of things happened all at once. And you're like, that's a bad way to introduce someone to something like a tablet. But people keep framing it like, well, don't get your grandparents a nicer tablet, get them something cheap. They don't need more power. And you're like, they're exactly the kind of people who actually do need the most power possible in making the UI as responsive and as expected as you can make it. And that's one of the reasons, like, I think so many people pick up, like, the free tablet they got from their carrier, it works like garbage, and then they're like, well, I guess I need to spend $800 on an iPad. But we haven't been making those competitors in Android land. Like, the last days of LG were dire. I mean, like, $100 Android tablets, man, avoid, like, the plague. And even some of the TCLs where it's like, this is reasonable and it's an okay price to performance, but, like, my daughter can't play games on this. She can do kind of like some of the basic, like, I'm a school game and you can use me to learn about addition. But if she wants to play Shredder's Revenge, that's not going to happen. The tablet can't handle Shredder's Revenge. So I'm thinking if we want to do kind of like a nice tablet for Lex, I'd need to get like a beefy case for it. I'm worried I'm going to pick this up, like, if I do get a loaner, and I'll use it and then be like, I guess I need to buy one. And then I also need to buy like a $1,500 phone in the same month. It's going to hurt. It's going to hurt really bad. So we'll see. I'm tentative. I don't know that I'm going to jump on this OnePlus pre-order, this deposit. I don't know that I like this vibe. It's a fun kind of game, but I don't know that this motivates me to give them $100 to try and get, I mean, basically just get the keyboard for free. I don't know. I'm stuck. Oh, Fungi. Yeah, seriously. I mean, again, I'm going to spend some time with the OnePlus Pad, but I might end up with the Lenovo instead. Fungi says, I didn't realize that the P11 Pro Gen 2 was such a good value. I prefer OLED, so it's huge for me that it has that. Ironically, would be my first high refresh rate mobile experience. And on a tablet screen, that'll be really nice if you do jump on one of those. And then Goat V8 also says, kind of off topic, but Lenovo does a tablet that does video in as well. And I think that's an amazing feature for a tablet. I am consistently disappointed that we don't get laptops and tablets with video input. It's such an obvious feature. Like, you can use it as a second display for something else, and then it's its own computer on the side. The only one that I played with was actually another Lenovo. It was their iMac clone, and it had this one little HDMI port, and you would plug in the HDMI port and it would go, do you want to switch over to the secondary input? And you'd say, yes, I do, Lenovo. And then it was like a giant TV. It was a quad HD screen on a folding. It could fold all the way flat and then kind of pop back up. Like, they had all these other things, like you could play board games on it. You'd never do that. But it was so cool. I hooked up a PS3. I'm gaming on it. You could switch back over. It was a full Windows PC. There's no reason why your laptop shouldn't be able to do that too. You've got your like travel laptop. It's thin, it's light, it gets good battery life. And then you just switch it over to input. The computer shuts down and then you plug in your Steam Deck and you've got a portable monitor to game on your Steam Deck. Why can't we have that? But just on our way out, let me pull up the Lenovo. Lenovo P11 Pro 2nd Gen. So this will not be as powerful as a OnePlus, but I just wanna show this off here. Oh, do I have like my screen? Yeah, let's make that a little smaller. So 2.5K OLED, it's an 11-inch screen, HDR10+, 120Hz refresh rate, 360Hz touch sampling, also 4-channel speakers. Second screen, your tablet as a wireless touch monitor for your laptop. And it is pen compatible. And there is a keyboard that's available for it too. Looks like a nice, thin, light tablet. I don't believe it has a headphone jack. I'm trying to see. Nope, I don't think it has a headphone jack. It's using pogo pins for that keyboard dock. But then it starts at... What is the price on this? Oh, the website got all weird. Yeah, that got all jumbled up. So there's a $340 version and a $430 version. The original MSRP, the starting price, was $400. So I don't know what the difference is between the $300 and the $400, though. They just might not have... Oh, there's a 6 gig and a 4 gig. So 6 gigs of RAM. You'd probably want that one. That takes you up to $430. But it's running a MediaTek, but let's see what the specs are. So it's a MediaTek Companio 1300T. So the Companio has quad A78 cores and quad A55 cores. So does anyone want to guess what would a Companio 1300T be similar to in terms of phone processors? Does anyone want to guess? Anyone want to hazard a guess if it's got four A78s and four A55s? What would that kind of be like? And Dave Burns nailed it! It's similar to a Snapdragon 855! Depending on clock speeds, it might be in between an 855 and an 865. Because the 865 was also A78, A55, but had the one overclocked core. So this is a substantial amount of processing power for... I'd step up to 430, and at that price, at 430, you're running up against the Razer Edge. And the Razer Edge is closer to a Snapdragon 888 with active cooling. So you could go Razer Edge and have a sort of a more gaming-focused, high-performance experience, or you could go more corporate, you could go more business-style, and go with the Lenovo P11. But both of those, sub-$500, monster computers that can do a whole lot of extra stuff. Video output, good battery sizes. They don't say what their charging rate is. It's an 8,000 milliamp-hour battery, but I don't know how fast the charging is. It doesn't seem to say, but it is an OLED. Again, the Razer Edge is going to be smaller, but also has a gaming OLED on it. Could be pretty good. Could be really good. So I was just recently showing off the OnePlus Pad. Very excited for the OnePlus tablet coming out. It's things like this Lenovo Tab P11, the OnePlus Pad. We know there's going to be a Pixel tablet coming out soon. That Pixel tablet is facing incredible pressure. Like, I kind of believe a Pixel tablet is going to be somewhere in line like $499. And this Lenovo Tab is going to undercut it. And the performance delta between a Tensor Gen 2 and a Companio 1300T is going to be pretty close. Yeah, Fungi 455. It's kind of like an 855 plus. Aditya Anil's, it's spot on. It's somewhere in this ballpark. The Companions are a little different because they are the tablet and notebook ARM chips from MediaTek. It's not like the Dimensity. But the core configuration still gives us a clue as to how this thing might perform. And Aditya was saying somewhere like an 865. I can tell you, like, I was just holding up my Duo 1. So this is a Snapdragon 855. This is one of my all-time favorite tablets. It does tablet-y things really well. It multitasks really well. You don't sit here and feel like, oh, I can't do moderate to heavy work on my Duo because it only has a Snapdragon 855. especially for like documents and PenTouch stuff. Like I sign documents on this thing all the time. The only reason I'm not is because I'm currently using a Moto that also has stylus support. You're not hurting at an 855. You're feeling pretty good at an 855. And especially when you can get a brand new OLED screened tablet for under $500. Google has a hard fight ahead of them, and they're the ones that are trying to revive Android for tablets. Oh, Fungi, that's hilarious. Fungi says, I feel like I cheated because I was actually searching up the comparison between the 865 and the 1300T before you asked the question. No, that's knowledge, man. Share the wealth. Because again, I feel like we lose sight of what is the real practical output of a gadget like that. If you have a Snapdragon 855, you still have a monster performer today. So much so that even these like sort of lower cost but high performance and business grade tablets are still coming out with hardware built around that kind of core configuration. You go pick up a $200 phone and it's got something that's in the ballpark of an 845 or an 855, that is still gross overkill for this idea of covering the basics. I can show you where when I pick up a Snapdragon 8 Gen 2, how it totally cleans the clock of an 865. It is more powerful. It's coming in at a better performance per watt ratio. The GPU is incredible if you're doing high intense graphics gaming. But you have to push to increasingly enthusiast levels of work and fun to get the benefit of an 8 Gen 2 over the lowly Snapdragon 855. If you're in that same window of, hey, I'm using it to kind of do some document work and surf the web and read on it and stream some video and play some light games, and I'm talking light games like Alien Isolation. Alien Isolation runs pretty well on a Snapdragon 855. Doom 3 runs really well on a Duo 1 with a Snapdragon 855. Doom 3, if that's your kind of flavor of old school, first person, intense, demonic shooter, this is tackling Doom 3. I need people to ask, am I regularly cutting 4K 60 frame per second video to a degree where the increase in video rendering output would make a noticeable difference to my daily workflow? And am I playing games more graphically intense than Alien Isolation and Doom 3 on the regular on my phone? And if the answer to both of those questions is no, then an 855 is still stupid overkill for your needs. I love it. We should be so excited about this. We can hit this holding pattern where incredible technology that completely covers like our daily needs, these kinds of tasks. Starting price $339, $340, rounding up that extra penny. Awesome. As enthusiasts, we should be able to throw out the mission accomplished banner. Like, we should not ever need to worry about, like, family and friends getting something that is a stupid, underperforming, cynical cash grab of a product. Because, like, a Lenovo Tab P11 Pro Gen 2 exists. And is this baller of a tablet. Yeah, Sushi! Dude! For reals, where'd your comment go? Oh, there it is. Sushi Love 67. I have the OnePlus 7T. It has the 855 Plus. It's still fast. You know why it still feels fast? Is because it is still crazy fast. It's awesome. I love it so much. Goat V8. As an average consumer, I only do Geekbench scores and hour-long Genshin sessions on my phone. 855 won't cut it. And you know what I love is, like, This is true. I mean, like, when we talk about benchmarking a phone, I will get really excited about, like, a 5% improvement to 4K video rendering because I do that on my phones. It matters to me if I'm out in the field and I can reliably count on an improvement to getting the video finished. That matters to me. I will pay more for that. But it's also doubly true when we talk about stuff like gaming. They're freaking out, like, this is a 10% improvement in GPU performance. And do you know what that means? That means like 2.5 frames per second. It means 3 frames per second better. I'm not arm waving if Genshin is 4 frames per second better. That's not a huge difference to the play style and to the experience of Genshin. But it is a scientific improvement that we can demonstrate. And if you're really into like game benchmarking and GPU benchmarking and stuff like that, 10% is a pretty big number and we get excited about that level of performance. But like, that's why I feel like the excitement doesn't transfer to the end users. The excitement stays with the enthusiasts and we're flipping out like 15% better is going to just blow your mind. And then the end user is going to pick it up and go like, it looks kind of the same. It's 4 frames per second faster. I'm not sure my gameplay experience has been improved going from 30 frames per second to 34 frames per second. Like, that's better, but that's not something I think you can see. You really impress someone when you go from like 30 frames per second to 45 or 30 frames per second to 60 frames per second. They'll notice that. Man, let me tell you, when I can show some people, like, even Dead Cells at 100 frames per second looks so good. And I can put that into someone's hands and say, look how fluid this gameplay is. And they'll recognize that. Alien Isolation at 35 frames per second is not functionally different than Alien Isolation at 30 frames per second. So, that's pretty great. Oh, yeah, Large Ebus. So you're right on the cusp there. Literally only felt the need recently to buy a new phone to cover my PUBG needs. The old 845 lasted till now, so normies shouldn't worry. LOL. My wife actively took a step down. So she went from an LG G7 with that Snapdragon 845 to a Pixel 4a 5G with a Snapdragon 765, which is technically a little less powerful than that Snapdragon 845, and she's good. She's perfectly content with that tier of performance. She's doing just fine. And if we get her a Sony, it's going to be really expensive, but not because she cares about performance. She doesn't. She is handled just fine at like a $400 mid-ranger, but we can't get her the phone that has a headphone jack anymore. And that's gonna hurt. We're gonna have to vote with our wallets, but that one's gonna be expensive. Oh, excuse me. Sorry, I had to clear my sinuses there. So, I think this is about time. We should probably start wrapping this up. I had one other article I was gonna point to, just as a friendly heads up for folks out there. If you have, I don't even think I kept it in the lineup. Google's going to be dropping support for old drop cams and stuff. That was going to be a part of the gadget block, but we can just wrap this up. This podcast is 2.5 hours long, so I feel like we have had our conversation. Some really crazy exciting news coming up. Big announcements next week from Xiaomi, and then the week following from OnePlus. My wallet is going to be hurting again very, very soon, I feel, but we've got some really cool things to talk about. And along that way, we're going to be wrapping up some other conversations on some of these phones. Some Vivo videos are going to be coming out. I finally got through the block of finishing up my Galaxy Note video. I've got to wrap up the Vivo V27s. I've got the script written for a Razer versus gaming phone showdown. There's some really interesting things that are happening that I really hope we can kind of spend some more time, for the enthusiasts, spend a little more time just kind of keeping up with the way that these products evolve. Because it's not just product is launched and I have unboxed it and this is my first impression on it. Okay, smash that bell icon. I mean, we really need to kind of finish the conversation as some of this stuff goes through. So stay tuned. I'm going to have some e-bike stuff out. I got some saddlebags and a bike rack for my e-bike, so I feel all practical. I can carry groceries better. Some battery videos. I'm working with a company. Maybe we can get some solar panel videos out and just talk about sort of the whole chain of generating power off the grid. Should be really fun. Once again, if you've been celebrating, I just hope everybody has been having a lovely holy day of their flavor over these last couple weeks. And I hope you and your family and friends are safe and well-fed, and that you've been getting to spend some time with people that care about you. And we'll be back next week. Another episode, Monday Morning Tech Chat Show, SGG QA podcast channel. So much tech news going crazy right now. And also, please stay on top of some of these other political issues. Like, we still need more support out there standing in opposition of the Restrict Act. I feel like that's another one that they're quietly trying to get out of the news cycle, but needs to be brought into people's attention more directly. So I'll probably have a follow-up to that next week, depending on what happens over this next week here. So be safe. I want you to take care of yourself so you can take care of others. I'll catch you back here next week. Another podcast. Be safe. I love you all. Take care.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs, is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.